We then drew near with the ship to the place where the savages dwelt and anchored, and lay there waiting for the other ships which we had lost in the storm, and which were expected to arrive. The settlement in which the savages lived was called Akutia, and the man whom we found there was called Juan Ferdinando, a Biscayan from Bilbao. The savages were called Carrios, and they brought us much game and fish, for which we gave them fish hooks. After we had been there for about 3 weeks, the ship arrived with the chief pilot, but the third ship had been lost and was never heard of again. We at once prepared to continue our voyage, having collected victuals for 6 months, for we had a voyage of some 300 miles before us. But one day, when everything was ready, the big ship foundered in the harbour and we could not proceed. We lay there for 2 years in the wilderness, in great peril, and so straitened for food that we were forced to eat lizards and field rats and other strange food, as well as the shellfish hanging to the rocks and creatures of that kind. Most of the savages who had first supplied us with food departed to other villages when they had obtained sufficient wares from us, and we were unable to rely on them for our support. It seemed as if we must remain there and die.
The adventure had scarcely begun for German seafarer Hans Staden when he came to that part of the narrative that he published in the 1550s. His account was called True Story and Description of a Country of Wild, Naked, Grim, Man-Eating People in the New World, America. And it became a classic story of exploration, confrontation, and conflict, remembered above all for its description of New World cannibals. How much of it is true? I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Year.
What prompted Staden to risk his life to come to the New World? How did Europeans and the Indians of Brazil regard each other in those early years of contact? And do we have other accounts to back up Staden's story of cannibalism? Our guest is Neil Whitehead, professor of anthropology at the UW-Madison and author of Cannibal Conqueror, Hans Staden and the Spectacle of Anthropology in Brazil, published by Duke University Press.
And welcome back to University of the Year.
Thank you very much.
Seems you're always studying cannibals and all kinds of exotic, strange peoples.
Well, I think to a large extent anthropology is driven that way. In fact, an argument was made that anthropophagy, people eating, was, if you like, the original problem for anthropology. It is the most difficult of cultural behaviors, apparently, to understand, and therefore calls exactly for the kind of cultural context that anthropologists hope to supply.
Now, the name Hans Staden, I have to say, I've never heard of him. He's not a Christopher Columbus household word. Why should we care about Hans Staden?
Well, because he's left a very vivid and unique account. Unique because he was captive for some 9 months with the Tupi savages, whom he refers to in his account. And that insider perspective very much runs along with the kinds of ambitions that modern anthropologists have. So we examine his account with particular interest, and I think that extended personal experience also comes through in his story, which is something of a ripping yarn in its own right. It really is written that way.
It certainly comes across as something like Robinson Crusoe, but 150 years before Defoe came along.
And all true. And I think, you know, there's a good chance Defoe may well have been aware of Hans Staden's story. Defoe set his own story, of course, also in America. And it seems likely that Hans Staden, although perhaps not such a well-known name today, was in the 16th to 17th centuries fairly well-known because there were many, many editions of his story very soon after it was published originally in German.
What do we know about Hans Staden before he gets to South America?
Not very much. He's a man of humble origins. He, as he tells his own story, really sets out as a youth for adventure. And this is what brings him to multiple voyages to South America. It's only on his last voyage that he's actually captured and held, and he has some 10 years of experience in South America before that. But he's skilled as a gunner, And it's as an gunner or artilleryman that he's taken into the service of first the Spanish and then the Portuguese. But beyond that, we know very, very little indeed about him.
What is going on in the New World in these 50 years since Columbus?
Well, as Columbus, as it were, you know, draws Spanish attention towards the Caribbean, Mexico, and then, of course, highland Peru, at the same time, the Portuguese are making their own westward voyages. And around about 1500, they begin coasting from roughly the Amazon mouth south along the coast of Brazil, seeking trade with all the different Indian tribes. Those voyages are not secret, not kept secret, and pretty quickly the French, as well as the Dutch, are also following those routes and themselves trying to pick up trade in Brazilwood in particular, but also jaguar skins and parrots and whatever they can trade for, as this sense of new economic opportunities in this region really grows throughout the 16th century. So we're really looking at a coastline where the French, the Dutch, the Portuguese, to a lesser extent the Spanish, are competing for the allegiance and trade that they might get with the coastal living Tupi.
What are they bringing in? What are they trading?
Well, very, very, simple manufactures, steel tools, fish hooks, pots, pans, cloth, beads, but of course the number one item is guns.
I was going to say, so things that it could ultimately be used against them.
Absolutely, and indeed there's quite a conscious policy of arming your allies so that they can act as a proxy military force against your opponents. And indeed, much of the unhappiness and misery of Staden is created through the fact that he's captured by Indians who are enemies of the Portuguese. And despite his insistence on being a German and not a Portuguese, he's unable to convince them of that fact. And so he's destined for sacrifice. And the same would have happened had Frenchmen fallen into the hands of the Indians with whom the Portuguese are allied. So this is very much a war being fought by proxy using tribal peoples.
So as a German, what exactly was he doing there? In other words, was his allegiance to the Portuguese, to the French, to...
Well, as in many of these early voyages, the ship's crews were put together without regard to ethnicity or nationality. So it was his skills as a gunner that were very valuable and originally brought him into the service of the Spanish. But as you hear from that opening passage, there's a problem that the original Spanish expedition gets shipwrecked and he spends 2 years trying to get back home. This doesn't damp his appetite for adventure, and he soon signs up again, this time with a Portuguese vessel. And then he gets taken across to just south of Rio de Janeiro, where the Portuguese have a fort, and he enters service there. When his time is up, they do all they can to persuade him to stay, not that it's that easy to leave. And so he finds himself doing another tour of duty, and it's during that last tour of duty that he's out, goes out from the fort one day hunting birds, and as he's in the woods hunting, he's suddenly surprised by a party of Tupinamba who sees him, spear him in the back of the leg, strip him naked, and carry him off to their village destined for sacrifice.
One of the things
that begins his tribulations.
One of the things that intrigues me about this account of his is how meticulous it is, how detailed it is from somebody who would not have had the ability to write any of it down at the time.
Well, I think this is a very good point, and I think we have to think about why the account was written. Essentially, one might consider it as a sort of ritual of his return. It's a way of reintegrating himself into his home society, German society. But of course, the fact that the story has a lot of interest for many reasons means that he is also able to attract the patronage of, in particular, Johannes de Leander, who was a professor of surgery at Marburg University, which was Hans Staden's hometown. And the book itself is dedicated to the Duke of Marburg, who himself had been held captive by the Turks. So one can see that captivity, possibly cannibalism, made his story of interest. And we think that, in fact, he gave the story orally and it was written down by someone else. And I'd just like to point out that although for us cannibalism is the most interesting issue perhaps in the book, the introduction to the book written at the time does not mention cannibalism at all, but rather suggests that the interest in Hans Staden's story is to do with the status of the eyewitness. In other words, as astronomical science, surgical science via dissection, all of these emerging disciplines rely on observation, and it is the nature of observation and how we may trust it, how we may come to rely on it, that makes for those who were reading his book in the day perhaps the most interesting feature.
Do we have any comparable accounts?
Of
others at this time, in this time period, who had similar experiences?
Well, indeed, there's two very famous accounts by French missionaries that are more or less contemporary with Hans Staden's experience, as well as accounts from Portuguese missionaries slightly earlier and slightly later. So within the sort of general literature on the Tupi, not only is what he tells us accurate according to these other sources, but most interestingly, he tells us things that aren't mentioned in any of those sources and which only perhaps an eyewitness with an intimate period of living amongst these people would be in a position to talk to us about. So one of the notable features is the emphasis he gives to the role of women in the whole torture and cannibalism and sacrifice of the enemy, something which doesn't occur in anyone else's accounts. And when you think about it, it's probably the only thing that you're going to see if you're there for an extended period of time. So there are many little details, as well as a sort of general social take on everything that's going on, that is very distinct from what I call the more priestly ethnologies of the moment, which are, you know, very, very professional, very much they were written by academics, but for all that have lost some of the vivacity and some of the odd details that otherwise turn up in Hans Staden. So he's a very valuable source ethnologically, quite apart from what else we might think of it as a historical document or a story in its own right.
So tell us what happens then after he's stripped naked and he's taken away. Why are they taking him, and why don't they just kill him right off? You know, what was the motive that they seem to have in keeping him with them, and what does he say about those early days of his capture?
Because essentially, Tupi warfare is not so much concerned with piling up dead bodies as it is with earning glory and spiritual advancement. And that can only be done by capturing your enemy, bringing them back to your home village, and with the collaboration and cooperation of your villagers and allied villages, holding a big ceremony at which your prisoner is sacrificed. This gives you his name, you gain his name, and within Tupian cosmology, this is a way in which humans can become divine beings. So the whole sacrificial complex, and I stress sacrificial because the moment of cannibalism is something that interests us, but may, in fact, does not seem to have had the central place in the overall ceremonial treatment of the prisoner. So the sacrifice enables the sacrificee to gain spiritual kudos, if you like, and sharing in the body parts of the sacrificed victim is a way of building political, marital, and social alliances amongst the Tupi themselves. Much as we might feel that a community of people who share communion every Sunday shares something more than a transformed flesh and blood of Christ.
So what happens then? I'm trying to picture him taken among these people.
Oh, I beg your pardon. Yes.
You know, just those early days.
So
how was he treated?
They drag him back to the village, and he's made to walk into the village with his ankles tied together. And someone calls out contemptuously, "Look, here comes our hopping food." And the general atmosphere is one of derision. They're calling him names. They're making fun of him. And then he's given to the women. In other words, the men, as it is in hunting, they capture the animal. But as you enter the domestic sphere, the animal or the captive is handed over to the women, who take Hans Staden and attempt to shave off his eyebrows and beard. But he insists that he should retain his beard, and this becomes his first of many psychological victories, because they say, well, fine, we'll leave you with the beard for the moment.
Now, did he know the language?
He did, because he'd been in South America, you know, over the last 10 years. So actually, there's every reason to think he knew the language extremely well. He'd been speaking and interacting with Tupi Indians for the past 10 years. The words that appear in his text are entirely accurate. And he even occasionally manages to quote quite philosophical statements in Tupi. So I think there's every reason to think that his linguistic knowledge was very good indeed. And certainly he would have needed good linguistic knowledge to wriggle and dodge the way he did to finally escape and come home to tell his tale.
So he is being prepared for this sacrifice.
Absolutely. And all that they're really waiting for is they need to move around to the other allied villages, give notice, hey, you know, we've captured a white man, we're going to sacrifice him, we need to collect in the manioc. And so everything's proceeding according to plan. And then he gets a toothache and he stops eating. And this isn't what they want to
see. This is right out of Hansel and Gretel, this part.
It feels like. And of course, I think, you know, one must always be wary in interpreting someone's biography. I'm quite sure he's giving himself good press. But we at least, I think, grant initial plausibility. I mean, it seems a not unreasonable thing to happen. But what happens next, I think, is unlikely to be quite so Hansel and Gretel. I think you make a good point, but he gets the toothache, so they, you know, forego the sacrifice. But then they themselves begin to fall ill. And it seems fairly likely that it's a disease that either he has transmitted to them or the French traders who are moving through the villages at all points.
Something that he, at this point, would be immune to.
Quite probably. It may be something as simple as influenza. The childhood diseases of Europe were completely fatal to the Amerindians of the Americas. So this is not an unlikely or an unusual scenario. What is unusual is that Hans Staden then suggests that the reason that they're all falling ill is because his God is angry with them. And however, he will, if they desist from eating him, agree to intercede with his God on their behalf. And they say, fine, please, please do. And he goes around and he lays hands on the sick Tupi. And of course, inevitably, some die, some recover. And most fortunately for him, one of the major war chiefs is one of those who recovers. And so he's basically made for life. That is, they have no more intention of sacrificing him. On the contrary, they're rather impressed by these strange powers. And the paradox now is that he can't get away because they don't want to let him go.
Too valuable.
Exactly, exactly. So out of one frying pan into a kind of fire.
How do they restrain him?
Well, there's no need to. I mean, there's nowhere to go. I mean, he has, you know, a very long walk or run to get back to the Portuguese. He doesn't have access to canoes. So it's just not feasible for him to... I mean, he might have set off on his own, but undoubtedly they'd have tracked him down. So, you know, it's rather like sending convicts to Australia or fine, escape, where are you going to go? So what's quite interesting, though, is that we do have accounts where native prisoners in a similar situation likewise did not escape. But there the reason may well have been that the shame that they would have felt on returning to their home village, the shame they'd have brought on their home village, made it functionally impossible for them to return, so that once captured there was really socially nowhere else for you to go.
What was the role of Hans Staden's religion coming into this?
Well, I think it's very important, and I want to back up slightly and say another reason for the form of the work, I think, is that it was very much in the style of a Protestant homily. There were texts very much like this circulating in Germany at the time, in which someone narrates some, you know, traumatic or extreme experience and refers to their faith in God as the reason that they live to tell the tale. And in fact, a formal comparison in a literary sense between the structure of the Verhaftiger, the True History, and other Protestant writings, homily writings of the day, shows that there's a lot of structural similarity. So I think it's important to realize that it was a tale that, you know, at one level he needed to tell in order to make sense of, you know, the incredible events that occurred to him, that others needed to hear, lest he appear somewhat tainted by his contact. This is a theme we find in captivity literature in North America very often. People, you know, even when they're returned, are rejected because they might have been touched or in some way polluted by their contact with the savages.
Sort of happened to Cabeza de Vaca in some ways.
In
he was
some
not
ways.
The same when he came back.
Well, no one is. And so, you know, I think the idea that his story would circulate amongst pious congregations of central Germany of the day was also his way back in to his German society. Because as far as we can tell, he returned to a small village near Marburg, Wolfhagen, which incidentally had a celebration of his life 2 years ago, which I attended. There's a Hans Staden Society there, and they had a marvelous little exhibition. And the last we hear of him is that he owes money to someone for gunpowder that he didn't pay for. So he seems to have folded himself back into, you know, a very obscure life, and I'm quite sure after all those adventures, sitting quietly at home was very pleasant.
There was one point, maybe the lowest point in his whole account, where he's all trussed up and he's on parade and he knows that he's going to be eaten. And he says, well, it occurred to me then that this was very much the humiliation that Jesus suffered his way to the cross. And that enabled him to bear
yes,
that.
I mean, his religion, I think, is massive. I mean, even if it wasn't before, it becomes quite evidently in his telling of his captivity a very central psychological means of sustaining himself. I think it's very notable. I mean, he did not ever like the Tupi. You know, there's no softening of his attitude.
Well, it's sort of hard to when you're seeing some of those rituals.
Right, but it's, you know, it's the, you know, what do they call it? The Copen? No, the Munich
Stockholm,
effect.
The Stockholm
effect.
Yeah.
I do beg your pardon. I mean, and Cabeza de Vaca, I think, gets a little more soft on the Indians. Mm-hmm. But certainly, I mean, the Tupi were a tough crowd. But I do think, nonetheless, that Hans Staden himself was a hard man, I think a very unpleasant man. And I say that because of his attitude when he got back. He begged many times a French trader who was trading in the village that he was held captive to help him. And that French trader, I think for political, if not for personal reasons, refused. When that French trader returned, the vessel on which he had returned to France was lost, and so presumably he was lost at sea. When Staden finally returned to Europe, he landed at Honfleur, a French port, and news of his return has happened. A boat from Brazil is in. And so actually relatives of the people who'd been on that French ship, including the relatives of the French trader, come down to see if there's any news. And Hans Staden, in his book, tells us that he said to them, no, he had no news. And in fact, he felt that they deserved to die for the way in which they had abandoned him. Now, whatever we think, it takes quite a hard man to tell grieving relatives that the people they feel may have lost, whether they were or not, he feels, deserved to die.
There was that one fellow slave, too, who was an enemy of his, and he seems to have taken some satisfaction in his fate.
Well, absolutely. I mean, in fact, at one point he says, well, killing your enemies is not so bad. It's just eating them. You know, I mean, he wasn't actually adverse to the violence per se. It was just having to eat them that struck him as a little off. You know, central Germany in the mid-16th century is a very violent place. And if you look at the literature that's coming out of his hometown, Marburg, I've, you know, looked at what they call the popular single-leaf woodcuts. These were rather like the National Enquirer of the day. My God, I mean, the subject matter of these are monstrous births, serial killers, execution of werewolves. I mean, the appearance of two suns over the city. So You know, in this phantasmagorical mental universe of central Germany, I think cannibalism, you know, registers slightly there. But truly, in its day, I don't think it could have been, you know, the big splash that we now feel was the reason, perhaps, that, you know, his tale gets repeated so often. So it's interesting to put it in its own context, as it were.
More on Hans Staden and his experiences among the Tupi Indians when we continue in a moment with the University of the Air.
As I arrived at the huts, I heard a great noise, with singing and blowing of trumpets, and in front of the huts some 15 heads had been set up on posts. These were the heads of their enemies, called Marakayas, whom they had eaten, and as they took me past them, they told me what they were. Then I was afraid, for I could not but consider that they might treat me in the same way. When we entered the huts of one of my keepers, he went forward and spoke with cruel words so that all might hear, saying, "Behold, I bring you a Portuguese slave," as if it were a fine thing for him to have his adversary in his power, and speaking much else besides according to their custom. He then took me to the place where the king sat, and he and his companions drank together of the drink called kawai until they were drunken. And they all regarded me with evil looks, saying, "Is not our enemy now come to us?" And I replied, "I am indeed come to you, but I am not your enemy."
One of the descriptions of 16th century German seafarer Hans Staden in his account of his time spent in Brazil, and in particular as a captive of the Tupi Indians, who, according to his accounts, quite detailed accounts, were in the habit of eating their enemies. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest Neil Whitehead. And, I mean, it's hard to get too far away from the cannibalism for one reason or another, but if we look at sort of the everyday social structure of the Tupi, this people in which Hans Staden was a captive for, what, 9 months, what other observations does he give us?
Well, really, we're looking at a society which is broken down into villages, strung out along the coast. Perhaps these villages, 1,000 to 1,500 people, quite sizable villages, perhaps we should be calling them towns. And they're essentially networked through systems of marriage and political alliance, in which these war chiefs play a huge role in bringing together bodies of warriors, in holding and sponsoring these big sacrificial ceremonies. But at the same time, that sort of civil authority is to some extent cut across by the religious authority of a class of shamans called the Karai. And they are not just shamans in the sense of being curers or those responsible for looking at the seasons and deciding on the time to hunt, the time to plant. And they are also visionaries. And one of the more interesting features of the Tupi society was their millennial traditions that would, it would seem, cause, you know, every few years for one of these prophets to lead a sort of messianic crusade into the interior of Brazil in search of Ive Marie, which was their term which we translate as the land without evil. So these were people also with a sort of cosmological as much as a political vision. And these mass millennial migrations really were very significant. People would stop planting. They would abandon the villages. And some of the migrations, they would proceed through the interior of the country almost like a predatory band, not unlike the European crusaders as they made their way to Jerusalem in their day. And some of them even reached the borders of the Inca Empire and raided the Inca Empire. So I think it gives us a sense of the way in which, even if people are living in fairly small political and family units, they certainly had both a broad vision of their place in the universe, but also their place in the geography of South America itself. So it's one of those paradoxes we see. Although they weren't necessarily dense urban populations, they were by no means simple, backward, primitive, or savage, as Hans so often calls them.
You mentioned that one of the unique things about his account is he does spend quite a bit of time talking about the role of women.
Yes.
Among the Tupi. How so, other than the preparations that you mentioned where they wanted to shave off his beard and so on?
Well, essentially because while captive, he is their property. The sort of analogy would be with a pet. I mean, the captive is like a household pet with all, you know, the indulgence, but all the limits on what, you know, you can do.
It's in Gulliver's Travels mm-hmm. the same way.
It's very, very similar. And again, I've got to say, perhaps some of this was suggestive for those works. But the women clearly, in Staden's account, have a collective presence in the ritual and social life that is erased or completely absent from the sort of missionary accounts. I think other authors, particularly, for example, Jean de la Rue, who wrote another very famous account of the Tupi, and he actually was present in Brazil at the same time as Hans Staden. But in the accounts of Jean de la Rue, there's a much greater tendency to, you know, identify the sort of blood hysteria of the women with something that begins to be rather like the witch's Sabbath. La Rue was a Calvinist pastor. He actually wrote up his account following the siege of Sancerre during the French Wars of Religion, in which he was part of the besieged community, and he witnessed cannibalism amongst that besieged community, which prompted him to write, to return, as it were, to the memories of his youth and his time amongst the Tupi, in order to draw a contrast between the sort of cannibalism at Sancerre and that of the Tupi. So what was shocking was this collective participation, not just of women, but I must say of the children as well, in these rituals of violence, which in Europe of the day were very much more seen as manly business and manly business alone. So there's a very, very interesting difference in the trajectory and dynamic of violence and ritual violence when you compare the Europeans and the Tupi. And it's the participation of the women, which is so shocking to other commentators, from which, in Staden's accounts, we get so many additional details. So as well as the ritual preparation on entry, they sit and drink with the captives on the night before execution. They're responsible for beautifying his body and for making and beautifying the club, which will be used to kill him. And in the detail that we can only get from Staden, they paint the head of the club with the same pattern that's painted on the forehead that is about to be crushed by it.
So it's kind of a work of art that they're
very much
it into.
So, very much so. And because of the consensual way in which indigenous sacrificial victims played their role, then, you know, seeing this as art, you know, understood as a positive and constructive feature of society, hard though that is for us to understand, was nonetheless, I think, the case for the Tupi, in the same way that we see certain kinds of self-sacrifice as being noble and positive, violent though they may be. Then the sacrifice that's going on for the Tupi is the highest expression of their value. And someone who doesn't, because the moment of sacrifice is one in which is quite ludic, in the sense that the captive isn't simply dragged out and clubbed. In fact, a cord is put round their waist, a pile of stones is put in front of them. And, you know, the idea is that they throw, you know, they have a sort of mock combat with the women. They throw stones at them and the kids throw stones back until the one designated as the executioner appears. And even then, the ropes only hold his waist, and for as long as he can dodge the executioner, he stays alive. Clearly the outcome is a foregone conclusion. But of course, it's how you play the game that is so important.
Was Hans Staden, once he gained a certain amount of credibility and even power among the Tupi, was he ever invited to participate in one of those rituals?
Well, indeed, after the sacrifice of an enemy, let me say that he was then regularly and reluctantly taken on all their raids to enemy villages. So they drag him around like a rabbit's foot everywhere they went. And he had to witness, you know, what went down in the war camps as well as in the villages. He saw many people sacrificed. But he himself is able to better his position because he not only did this curing, he goes on to say prayers to improve the weather, to change the wind, and these seem to have an effect. So his status as a potential shaman grows and grows. But his power is always circumscribed by the fact that although, you know, he may well be magical, you know, he's not married, he doesn't have relations. You know, in other words, he's not a citizen of this society, even if he's a very valued part of it. So his power is still such that he cannot negotiate his own release, and eventually it's done through a sort of piece of trickery rather than the consent of his captors. They reluctantly, finally, as it were, allow him to go, but it is a long process, and at no point really has he the power to do very much to change his position. He does attempt to intervene on the behalf of other captives on occasion without success. Noticeably, one of the indigenous captives that he intervenes on behalf of actually resents his intrusion, says that he wants to die, and Staden basically says, despite all his attempts to persuade him otherwise, he seemed perfectly content with his fate. He seemed as if he were going to a country fair. So this is a very nice way that we get a sense of the different subjectivities that are involved here.
This was a native captive?
Exactly. What may have appeared, you know, so dreadful and impossible to us may well have been a high point or a very noble destiny for someone else.
Now, he was there for 9 months, is that right? And what out of that 9 months shocked him the most when he's just in his account? When does Hans Staden seem to be taken aback the most?
Possibly when they kill and eat a sick prisoner. I think that's kind of just about where he, you know, expresses the greatest disbelief that they would do this. And in many ways, it is rather shocking. But I think, you know, they do this. This is a measure of their own desperation. Because we mustn't forget that even, you know, as Hans is suffering at their hands, within 10 years of his account, all of these Tupi have vanished through epidemic disease. They are on the cusp of a huge holocaust. They are a society that already knows that it's in desperate straits. And this is one of the reasons that they are taking Portuguese, Germans, whoever they can get, sick people, and sacrificing them, as if it were, you know, redoubling their efforts in the face of looming disaster for the lack of any other strategy. So, you know, this was probably somewhat shocking to them, but it certainly, for Hans Staden, seemed to be, as it were, their low point. But I guess, given everything else he's looking at, his tolerance has become pretty high over the months. So it's hard to think what would really shock this fellow now.
And was the cannibalism, was it mostly ritualistic, a way of sort of owning the enemy, or how much of it was practical, wanting food?
Well, I mean, you know, I love this question because I always give the answer, well, let's do the math. There's, what, 1,500 people at the ceremony? There's one body?
Not very,
I don't think anyone's getting much to eat tonight.
Good source of protein. Mm.
And very importantly, and as you might have seen in the book, you know, I did a rather gruesome, grim chart that shows you that the each body part, right down to the eyeball, you know, if I may, the lips of the vagina, you know, very, very precise, and I mention it because it's gendered and sexualized, have very specific destinations. So this is by no means, okay, you know, it's cooked, let's eat. This is a very, very precisely ordered dismemberment and distribution of human body parts amongst allies and affines and the like.
And it's always somebody from another tribe or population. There's never any sacrifice within the tribe, as you might see among the Inca, for example.
Right. I mean, the context for the capture is always agonistic, let's put it that way. It's important that the captive is brought back as a result of some kind of struggle, combat. You know, it wouldn't do just to grab anyone because it is to do with, you know, accessing the inherent power that is thought to adhere to someone showing bravery, generosity. And I link those fierceness amongst people I'm currently working with. The one word, asa, means all three things. To be fierce, to be generous, and to be brave is one word. And it's really that generosity and fierceness which is the ideal characteristics of the war chief, who is both fierce in battle and generous in sacrifice and sharing the fruits thereof. So we begin to get glimpses, too, of other kinds of moral value systems that lay behind what now appear to us as such peculiar behaviours. But I must slip in here, you know, behaviours that we ourselves are obsessed with and whose our own history is, you know, very much entangled with. As I point out in the book, until 1903, the German drug company Merck's had at 5 pfennigs an ounce for sale a substance called mamia, which was nothing less than the ground-up bodies of Egyptian mummies that were being exported on an industrial scale. So we too believe in the life-giving, renewing properties of eating human bodies.
A few more thoughts and observations about the 16th century explorer Hans Staden when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. In Paris in 1927, Brazilian composer Heitor Villa-Lobos needed to attract more people to the concerts of his music, and he concluded that the fastest way to do it would be with some powerful publicity. He decided to play up his exotic origins. He gave a long interview in which he told a remarkable story. The resulting article appeared soon after a concert of his music. It was called The Adventures of a Composer, Cannibal Music. In it, Villa-Lobos told of being captured by cannibals and continuing to compose even during the 3 days before he was to be roasted and eaten. The interviewer suggested that one item from the recent concert, 3 Indian poems, derived its themes from Indian melodies Villa-Lobos heard during his captivity, and that he had gathered the savage sounds of another piece, Nonetto, as he waited for death. Those familiar with the captivity narrative of 16th-century German mariner Hans Staden found Villa-Lobos' account remarkably similar.
That's an account of the 20th-century reaction to Hans Staden. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is Neil Whitehead, whose recent book is called Hans Staden's True History, an account of cannibal captivity in Brazil. Hans Staden lived in the 16th century, mm-hmm. but as that opening suggests, mm-hmm. he continues to be sort of a cultural figure. What kind of uses do you find Brazilians making of Hans Staden today?
Well, I mean, this is one of the reasons that I felt emboldened to do what otherwise might seem obscure, some story from the 16th century. Who cares anymore? But in fact, Hans Staden is a very important figure culturally in contemporary Brazil. Manuel Lobato's children's version of his story has been in continuous print since 1932, running to something, you know, like a dozen editions. There was a very important film, How Tasty Was My Little Frenchman, which of course, plays with the story, but in the 70s, which was a sort of covert criticism, a critique of the then military junta in Brazil. It was remade again by Nelson dos Santos just 4 or 5 years ago as a more sort of faithful and straightforward retelling of the film. And a graphic novel by João Oliveira was issued in 2005. So Hans Staden remains, I think, perhaps as a figure like Davy Crockett or General Custer might for us, this very important symbol of a time and a moment, a reference point through which Brazil might understand its own past and its own attempts to be a plural society. I would note, too, that Mario de Andrade, the leader of the so-called leader of Brazilian modernist movement in the 30s and 40s, termed the movement the Anthropofagistas, again taking inspiration both from Hans Staden and the cannibal legacy of the Tupi, with the idea that the only way to create a real Brazilian modernism would not be to, as it were, imitate Europe, but to eat it up and, as it were, turn it into something completely different. So just as cannibals are ever interesting to all of us, in Brazil in particular, this motif and Hans Staden's story has come to stand for, you know, many kinds of national imaginary, national longings and hopes. So he's a very contemporary figure as well.
Do you think some of it is kind of an interest in things that are titillating and taboo? You know, I noticed, for example, in one of the reviews of your book, it says, it is rare that academics get to translate and interpret such gory material, and the result is as fleshy as any red-blooded anthropologist is ever likely to encounter.
Well, it's very sweet of them to have said so, but I have the feeling that the reviewer there was getting rather more excited than anything in Hans Staden might allow him to. But the point here is exactly that. Hans Staden remains so relevant, remains so redolent to us because we are still obsessed. We are still concerned about cannibalism. Not only is it theologically important for all kinds of reasons, but it remains in the Western imagination as one of those horrible things that happens. You know, whether it's the, you know, the Charrua rugby team in Uruguay coming down in the Andes, yes, and being forced to eat each other. Or, you know, the idea from any number of, you know, the current schlock horror, torture porn kinds of movies in which, you know, as a society, we're trying to plumb the limits of our tolerance, our ability to entertain certain kinds of possibility. And cannibalism, you know, I'm sure for a whole suite of Freudian reasons that another could trot out, remains this very, very deep human anxiety. So it will always have a certain kind of topical spin. And I think in the West, as I say, because of the theological and the colonial background, it has perhaps remained even more important to us than others. And for the Brazilians, it's not so much the cannibalism, shall we say, as the nature of Staden and other of those early adventurers along the Brazil shore as these interstitial figures who might, as it were, provide some clue as to how to be a Brazilian and not a European. Do we have to, as Staden found, import the nationalities of Europe to the shores of Brazil? Because it all came down to the fact that the French wouldn't admit him to be, as he hoped he would, a fellow Christian, but rather insisted on the nationalities of the question. So in many ways, the modern world began there, and those same issues that were being debated right there between Hans, his captors, and the French traders are very similar to the ones that we have today, because the issues of nationalism, the issues of the way in which violence and religion relate together, none of those things have gone away. And of course, I'm sure the word Islam will all remind us of how we're so keen to find, as it were, new cannibals, new terrorists. And it may interest you to know that an early reissue, unauthorized reissue of Staden used pictures taken from the Middle East to illustrate the cannibal passages.
Was the original illustrated?
Yes, it was, heavily illustrated. One of the most outstanding features of a 16th century book, 54 separate woodcuts. So if no other reason, this would be a notable book of its day. So the visual register is really, really extensive, but I think this relates to the fact that it was intended to circulate, as I said, as some kind of religious tract amongst a population that may not have had universal reading skills and for which the pictures were a very, very good aid memoir. Because when you look closely, the pictures themselves, you know, don't obey any, you know, compositional or perspectival logic. They're much more like cartoon frames.
Yeah, almost like diagrams. Yes.
Absolutely. So they were probably used, you know, in conjunction with the text or not to work through the story. You could, as it were, retell yourself the story once you'd heard it just by looking again at the pictures.
Did he have doubters?
In his
own time and I assume since.
I think the doubters in his own time were very much fewer than those that have built up subsequently. And in particular, in the last 20 or 30 years, the issue of cannibalism, how much credence to give to these colonial reports, has been a very, very fraught one for anthropology. So certainly there are plenty of scholars out there who would come onto your program and say, well, Whitehead's got it all wrong, Hans Staden, it's a complete fabrication, it's an expression of colonial ideology.
And could it be a fabrication? In other words, could it be that Hans Staden wanted a bestseller and that he also wanted to, you know, celebrate his own exploits and escape, and that it's based on anecdotal, you know, hearsay that he never actually was captured for 9 months?
Well, it could be in the same way I guess someone else might have written Shakespeare's plays. It could be. Because, in fact, the kind of evidence we would wish for that would make it impossible to escape one or other conclusion simply doesn't exist. But the skeptical argument, I think, breaks down because you're left to explain how he could have got such intimate and particular knowledge repeated nowhere else, which, with all the best Brazilian, American and European experts on the Tupi looking at it, seems to be exactly the case. So, in fact, I think it's rather harder to work the angle it's all made up than it is to go with what seems to be very evident, that some kind of experience, even if some of the details are happily changed to reflect him in his own good light, I don't deny that. But I think he was there for a long time, and if he was there for a long time, he would have seen many of the things he claims to have done.
Well, it is told in a very detailed and, despite the subject matter, almost matter-of-fact way throughout.
Yes, I mean, you feel if you'd have made this stuff up, you'd have done a lot better than this. I mean, you know, because what comes out is sort of contrary to expectation. And this business of giving the women such prominence is absolutely contrary to assumption and expectation of the day. So why would you, you know, do something more complicated and write all that in, leaving yourself with these difficult things to explain? I mean, I think ethnological fabrication sounds as if it should be straightforward, but is actually a lot harder than one might imagine, because life is always much stranger than fiction.
It's been a strange and fascinating hour with our guest, Neil Whitehead, and illuminating Hans Staden, a 16th century, what shall we say, historian who is still very much with us. Thanks for being with us.
Well, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and I hope you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Air.